Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll begin our look back at the books that were published in 2025. It's near the end of the year, time to look back at some of the year's literary achievements. We began the year with the first novel from memoirist Constance Adler, whose first book was My Bayou, New Orleans Through the Eyes of a Lover. In Sight Unseen, she chronicled the fortunes of a young couple as they moved to New Orleans and thought about starting a family. The main character, Claire, was a photographer.
Well, it cracks me up, sort of, because your first book had the subtitle New Orleans Through the Eyes of a Lover.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still writing about New Orleans through the eyes of a lover in this book, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I also wanted to pursue in this novel, just in general, how looking at something changes it. Looking at something mm-hmm. helps to create it. And looking at something with love, through the eyes of a lover, really manifests that beauty in the thing that you see. And so I think so much of what I've written, both in my first book and my second book, I've created by looking at it, by seeing it, by choosing to see it a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very active sort of creative choice, to look with love.
Oh, I love the nighttime garden. It's such a rich metaphor. Now, are you a gardener yourself?
I am. I have a very tiny garden. And this is another thing that I love about New Orleans, is like, even with a very small garden, you can accomplish a lot. A little plot of land can produce so much. And it's astonishing to me how much grows all around me. And I've planted several trees on my small property over the past 20 years that I've lived there. And it's such a pleasure to see how well these trees are doing, how tall they've mm-hmm. become, and to know I put them there. I got them going. I got them started. It gives me a great sense of accomplishment, almost more than writing a book. You know?
And a little less work.
Another much-anticipated first novel was Dominion by Addie Kitchens, whose book was the first in a publishing residency program with Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This story of a local hero, who's not all he's cracked up to be, offered hard truths about men and women in small-town Mississippi.
I love the way you always give your women all the chances they want or will take. And their voices are so strong. I mean,
thank you.
Why did you choose this structure?
It's kind of like the structure wouldn't leave. When I had written an earlier draft, I had spoken with an agent who loved the story, who really wanted me to change around the structure. And I just couldn't do it. For some reason, it had to be this way for me. And I think part of the structure came from like the communal choral aspect of, you know, the town's voice.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is because I really wanted to get into the head of women who are like my mom, like my aunts. And I really wanted them to get their ideas out, good or bad. You know, so I wanted to hear from them. I also say I didn't. There were drafts where I used more of the men's voice, but I always say, like, cishet males are like the apex predators. And so if I'm asking their opinion in the book, it's like asking the wolf why they hunt. You know, they're just going to justify eating you. And so that's why I chose to not too much do their perspective, but you see them. Because it's kind of like men are allowed to kind of plod all over everything and all through the age, and you're just avoiding the footfalls. And
like one of the characters says, a man gun man.
Yeah. Exactly.
Poet Skye Jackson in Libre drew on her own experience as well in Can I Touch Your Hair, for a poem that gained national attention.
Now, you had this wonderful experience that comes along every now and then for a few lucky poets, and that's having a poem break through and get a kind of attention that a lot of poems don't get. And it's this wonderful poem called Can We Touch Your Hair?
Yes, yes.
And Billy Collins picked that for the Library of Congress Poetry 180 Project.
Yes, and so I ended up getting this email from the Library of Congress one day saying, Billy Collins has selected your poem for our anthology. And I was like, what? You know, it
Thank you, Billy Collins.
Right. It was so out of the blue. I remember it was during the summer. I just woke up, looked at my phone, and was just shocked.
Of course.
Just shocked. But yes, that's what happened.
So I wonder if you'd read that poem for
I'd be happy
now.
To. Can we touch your hair? At the parades, everyone wants to touch my hair. On the corner of St. Charles and Marengo, I am cold and smashed and puffy AF. When two white women try to convince me that they love my hair, no, they really, really do, they say, because it is so black and thick and curly and soaking up all of the water in the damp air. The mousy one says through an Alabama drawl, God, you can do so much with it. And her blonde friend says, you can't do a damn thing with mine, won't even hold a curl. She runs away to grab another friend and says to her, Stacy, isn't it even prettier than Macy Gray's? We just love her, don't we? They circle me and ask, can we touch your hair? Then, suddenly, just like my ancestors long ago, I am pulled apart, soft, by pale hands from all directions.
Oh, gives me chills. Gives me chills.
Thank you.
Poet Chuck Perkins published Beautiful and Ugly Too. It took its title from Langston Hughes and included prose as well as poetry. He shared discovering the joy of reading while he was serving in the armed forces.
So tell us about the title. It comes from an epigraph by Langston Hughes, who inspires everybody.
You know, the title Beautiful and Ugly Too, Langston Hughes wrote an essay that was in The Nation in 1926. And I guess, you know, he was referring to all of the black creatives that were moving to Harlem in the early part of the 20th century. And, you know, the line, he says, well, if white people like what we do, then we appreciate that. But if they don't, then it doesn't matter because we know that we're beautiful and ugly, too. Mm-hmm. So that's where it comes
100 years.
Yep.
Langston Hughes.
You're right. I didn't think about that. But that was from 1926, and now it's 2025. And you know, I had always, for some reason, I'm a pretty avid reader. I read a lot.
Yeah.
And I always thought that James Baldwin had said that. but then I was reading a collection of writings by Alan Locke. You know, some people refer to him as the father of the Harlem Renaissance.
Yes.
And that's when I realized, no, that quote was actually from Langston Hughes. So.
The great guides, Langston Hughes, James Baldwin. Now, you mentioned a lot about reading in this book, which I enjoyed a lot, of course, being me. I mean, you talk about reading the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Yes.
Fannie Lou Hamer's autobiography, mm-hmm. rather. Mm-hmm. And John Hope Franklin's From Slavery to Freedom.
I got to tell you about that John Hope Franklin book.
Like a great man. He's just a great man.
He really, really is. I grew up in, here in New Orleans, a neighborhood we call Pigeon Town, right?
Sure.
And I was a working class, working poor. That was the community I was from. Unlike a lot of my friends, my father was actually a school teacher. And of course, he was always trying to encourage us to read and do your homework and do this and do that. But when I was a kid, I wasn't so interested. I wanted to play football. I wanted to have girlfriends. I wanted to have friends. I wanted to do anything but read. You know, it was like getting some, like pulling teeth. It's like, do I have to? Do I have to? And so I ended up, after high school, I went to the Marine Corps. When I was in the Marine Corps, I ended up on a ship called the USS Hermitage, and we were doing they call them floats. We did a 6-month float on the Mediterranean, right?
Whoa.
Now, it's something, you know, like if you tell like the average 18-year-old that, you know, we're going to pay you and you don't have anything to do. You know, most 18-year-olds be like, great, where can I sign up for that, right? And so I end up on the ship. The ship was commissioned in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, you know, Marines were not living on ships for 6 months at a time. The Navy would pick the Marines up and drop them off. Uh-huh. But now we're living on these ships and it's really not built for that. And there is nothing for us to do. And so for the first 2 or 3 weeks, I did exactly what I knew from growing up in Pigeon Town. We played spades. We played talk. We shot dice. Right. that's what we. But, you know, for me, after about 3 weeks, mm-hmm. Oh, my God. I'm talking about there were dates when we literally played cards for maybe 12, 13 hours a day.
Ah, but did you play for money?
We played for money, too. We did. But still, after about 3 weeks of that, I was like, man, I don't want to see another card at all. I don't want to shoot dice. I don't want to do any of that. And so I decided I'm going to go in the library and just find
a
book.
So there was a little library on the ship?
There was a library on the ship. And I'm going to go in there and find a book. And at that time, I got to tell you, I mean, I knew who James Baldwin and Langston Hughes was, but I can't say that there was a book that I'd always heard about or that there was something I really wanted to check out. I just said, I'm going to go there and see if I find something interesting.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that I walked in there and I looked at the shelf and there it was, From Slavery to Freedom by John Hope Franklin.
Oh.
Now, this book is probably about 600 or 700 pages. So off the top, that's really intimidating. I'm like, man, I don't even like to read. How am I going to read a book that's 700 pages long?
And they use it as a textbook.
Yeah. And you know what? I read the entire thing. Oh. And an incredible thing happened to me. I felt like I had evolved a little as a human being. Because after sitting down and reading this one book, I'm not being hyperbolic. This is not an exaggeration. I felt like I knew more about what it was, you know, the contribution of Black people, what it was to be a Black person mm-hmm. in this world. I had learned more in reading that one book than I had read in my mm-hmm. entire kind of, you know, 17 years of being, however, 13 years, however many years of being educated mm-hmm. In the school system, and I liked the way that felt. And so I wanted to read more after that.
If you're just joining us, we're looking back at the best books of 2025. Novelist Bernice McFadden turned her talents to memoir with Firstborn Girls. And one of the most powerful moments is when your mother saved your life, pulling you from a burning car wreck on your second birthday.
On my second birthday, yes.
Itsy bitsy, I mean.
Yeah, we had traveled to Cleveland, Ohio to spend some time with my grandmother's former boyfriend and his new wife. My mother wanted to go see her family in Detroit. She wanted them to see me because they hadn't seen me.
Yeah.
And so the former boyfriend said, take my Cadillac and just drive, because I think it was about 2 hours, a 2-hour drive. And so that's what she did. And it was late at night. The highway was pretty empty, if I remember the story correctly, not a whole lot of overhead lights. And when she went to take the exit, a car that was speeding behind her didn't see that she had her clicker on and rammed right into the back of the car.
Oh.
And the car exploded immediately.
And I can just see little bitty you.
Mm-hmm.
I can just see and her determination to pull you from that inferno.
Yeah. I was stuck in the seam of the front seat. I had been sitting in the back seat, but I was playing with the ashtrays and it was aggravating her. So she pulled me up to the front seat, and thank God, because had she not, we would not be having this conversation.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, what a moment. Mm-hmm. What a moment. One of the things that I love the most is the way we remember specific books. You remember The Color Purple.
Yes.
And I wanted you to read a little bit of the part about reading that book for the first time.
I'd been home 2 months when I discovered The Color Purple on the bookshelf wedged between Carrie and the Carpetbaggers. I plucked the hardcover from the shelf and stared at the cover image of the little country house surrounded by bold purple letters of the title and the author's name, Alice Walker. It was a well-read copy with dog-eared pages and annotations in the margins. These notes were not made in Vivian's looping script, which led me to believe that the book had been passed along to her. I took The Color Purple to my bed, lay down, folded one leg over the other, and began. Dear God, I am 14 years old. I have always been a good girl. Maybe you can give me a sign letting me know what is happening to me. The opening line spoke directly to me, and I felt seen in a way that I had never experienced in my reading life. Here was a girl, a black girl, just a few years younger than I, who was as tortured as I was. She was a good girl. I was a good girl. But that did not seem to be enough because she was black and ugly and the teenage mother of two children, sired by her father. When I finished the book, the sun was gone and the sky was slathered in that soft violet of summer evening. I closed the book and marveled at the emotion swirling in my chest. Over a span of 245 pages, I had been cracked wide open. Here, finally, was a story about my people, my messy, beautiful, dangerous, loving, grieving, curious, joyful black people. Black people like the people who raised me. Black people like the people who raised the people who raised me. I saw my entire family spread across those pages. Every single character in that book was familiar to me. I was so elated, so grateful, that when I closed the book, I wept. I'd never read a book that made me cry.
Another noteworthy memoir was Call Me Larry, A Creole Man's Triumph Over Racism and Homophobia by Larry Bonnaries, about his life as a gay rights activist in Houston and New Orleans.
Well, you have this incredible story about going to the New Orleans Public Library and looking homosexuality up in a book.
I was scared to death.
Yeah.
Because what I had done was I had prayed so hard. I would do three Stations of the Cross every Lent for 2 years in preparation for confirmation.
Uh-huh.
And I would pray to the Lord, please take this away from me. It still gets me. On the night the Archbishop came, Archbishop Romo, and I was in my red gown with the cap. But it was a big deal back then.
Oh, yeah.
And the Archbishop coming to the church and tapping me on the face, I thought, well, I don't get rid of it all. And it was still there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, I got another step I have to try. I went to the library, and I thought, well, what is this? And I made sure I went in the card catalog on the first floor.
Yeah.
That library is still there, and every time I go in there, I think about what I went through. And I looked up the word homosexual, which is, at the time and still is to me, disgusting, because it doesn't describe gay people as they should be described.
Mm-hmm.
And it listed it as a mental illness. And I'd say, well, if I have a mental illness, then I need a psychiatrist. And so I worked for the preset thing for 50 cents an hour for 2 summers, because I knew I was going to St. Aug, having seen the band at a very early age. And I thought to myself, well, if I can get the psychiatrist to do something, and all these prayers that I play, and St. Joseph is my patron saint for my confirmation name that I selected. I prayed and prayed and prayed, and nothing happened. Psychiatrist said to me, after all these prayers, and he took my $238 that I worked through so much to get. He said, we can help you. We have a shock treatment program.
Oh,
and for the
Larry.
First time in my life, St. Joseph came in and said, you can stick that up your, because you're not going to mess up my head, my brain. I still think today what could have happened to me if I would have subjected myself to that type of treatment that
and
many people did.
And what did happen, other people.
Yes, it happened to other people. And I got on a streetcar, was headed for the Dumain Street bus, and it stopped in front of Maison Blanche, and there were some picketers in front of it. And in the mind of a child, I thought, well, let's get rid of this black thing, and then there'll be a movement for gay people, I'm sure, just in my mind. So I tapped a picketer on the shoulder, and I said, I'll take one of those picket signs. Then I started marching toward the river, and a white woman passed and called me poor white trash. And then I turned around and go the other way. She spit on me first. Oh. And then she called me poor white trash. And then I turned around and went the other way. And a black woman said, you're not doing anything but causing trouble. You'd be able to be home helping your mama. And I thought, in my mind, I thought, they're not even correctly identifying me.
Right.
I didn't see it as an insult. I saw it as stupidity.
Yeah.
And so I began the civil rights movement then and mm-hmm. participated in a lot of demonstrations and stuff because of that.
So now that you're finished and you look back at your life, this is like a real rite of passage when you write a memoir. How does your life look to you? Does it look different than you thought? Is it bigger than you thought?
Oh, God, totally. I had no idea that you could take and celebrate being who you are, color-wise, sexuality-wise, mm-hmm. and age-wise. I would always run from my age. Well, I was 78 years old. I celebrate the fact that I've made it this far.
Yeah.
And the benefits of having good family and good friends and making sure that I try and translate that and give that to everybody I can reach out to. So the book's intention is to do those things and make sure that the world knows that every human being has a right to exist totally and free of intimidation. And so why I wrote the book was the same as I told you earlier, the three mm-hmm. reasons that the celebration of being a gay man is in this environment, having challenged and overcome those challenges.
It's such a joyful book. It really is.
Wendy Godan's Sunset Limited, an autobiography of Creole, traced her family history during the diaspora. It's a wonderful blend of memoir and narrative nonfiction.
As far as our stories go, and as clearly as the evidence points, my people were Mississippi Choctaw and Chittimacha and Eastern Cherokee, Fon and Yoruba, Amara and Fula, Haitian, German, French, Francophone, Cuban, and Scots-Irish. They were laundresses and seamstresses. They were printers, tinsmiths, and carpenters. They were farmers and oystermen, day laborers and physicians, bricklayers and Pullman porters, cigar makers, plasterers, deacons, priests, and nuns. Shredding every line that time and space and sovereignty drew around their bodies, my ancestors, the named and the unnamed, the dominant and the disempowered, the vowed and the fecund, the invaders and the invaded, the indigenous, enslaved, immigrant, and migrant, turned completely upside down what had been familiar in the world. They made something brand new, the first truly intercontinental tribe. They made the people who made me. The first time I came to Louisiana was for a family reunion on the Godin side in the 1990s. And I was here with my grandparents and my Aunt Rosie. And we traveled from New Orleans up the Mississippi River. We visited Nottoway Plantation as well as Homa House, or I think it may have an S at the end, mm-hmm. Homa's House. And we met extended cousins and family members that I had never met before. And I can remember being here and looking in the faces of my Godin cousins and seeing my grandfather's face and wondering, you know, if they could see my face reflected in theirs. And I remember sort of feeling like these twin things, like, wow, these are, quote unquote, my people. And then on the other hand, these are complete strangers to me, and I'm very different from them. I remember that distinctly.
Please join us next week for more of the best of 2025. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Dick Harpootlian signs Dig Me a Grave Friday, December 19th at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up, Kamala Harris's book tour for 107 days will bring her to the Sanger Theater January 13th. Tickets are available at Eventbrite, book sales by Baldwin & Company. If your New Year's resolution is to jumpstart that writing project, check out neworleanswriters.org with offerings from Allison Alsop, Jessica Kinnison, T. Clark, C.W. Cannon, and Beth Ann Fennelly.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.